everybody, welcome back to the Memories of Dallas show, part of the Memories Inc. network of shows. This is a show where we talk about all the people, places, and things related to Big D, Dallas, Texas.
Today I have another great interview. This is part one of a two-parter. Louise Key sits down with Saren Groom Knight, daughter of Dewey Groom from the Longhorn Ballroom. This is a great one.
Memories of Dallas is made possible through the generous support of Toothacres Pet Care Center. Toothacres is located in Carrollton, Texas at 1639 Parker Road. Toothacres Pet Care Center provides the finest indoor and outdoor boarding environment for your pet. With over 45 years of experience, the Clem family has created and maintained the highest level of excellence in the pet care industry. And they do it because they're pet owners too. For all your boarding needs, choose Toothacres. Toothacres offers cat and dog boarding as well as cremation and burial. You can reach them on the phone at 972-492-3711 or go to toothacres.com. And when you go, be sure to thank Lori Clem and the entire staff at Toothacres for supporting Memories of Dallas.
So, Saren, thank you so much for coming. This is going to be fun. I've been looking forward to this. I really have, because I know you've got stories.
I do have lots of stories.
Okay. Well, can we start just talking about your dad a little bit? Then I want to get into your stories, if that's okay.
Your father was Dewey Groom, a former owner of the Longhorn Ballroom.
He was born in 1918 in Van Zandt County, Texas. And there was seven of them all together. And they were poor. They never even owned property. They were tenant. They were tenant farmers. So they would work a farm a year or two, and then they'd move to another farm and work a year or two. So that was just their life. He had nowhere to go but up. And when he was about 15, I think he traded a bull calf for a little old guitar somewhere and taught himself to play. But his people were mostly Church of Christ singers, and they didn't have anything to entertain themselves after picking cotton all day, so they would all get together on the porch and they all just sang. So I guess, he grew up singing that way. And then when he got older, he hitched a ride to Dallas and worked at a gas station and started getting some radio work. And then it wasn't too long. Uncle Sam took him off in 41. And I think it was February of 41 he went to the service. It was before Pearl Harbor, which surprised me because I always thought it was after. But when I looked up his Army records, that's what it was.
Well, in doing the research, I saw that he came to Dallas when he was 10. Is that right? And because it almost sounded like he came on his own when he was 10, and I was wondering if that's true.
That must have been a typo.
Okay. Okay.
Definitely not when he was 10. He was a teenager.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah. Okay. Like I said, I think by the time he was 15 or 16, he looked around the cotton field. He said, something better than this. I do believe there was an uncle who ran a gas station, which what would probably be now the Accord, area. And he would sit around the gas station and play guitar and, pump gas, do whatever you had to do. It was better than picking cotton.
Yeah. Then you talked about he went off to the war. And then when he came back to Dallas. Do you know what happened in those years after the war before he kind of got involved with the Longhorn Ballroom?
Oh, yeah. As soon as he got out, he and my mom married in December of 45. And by then, and I don't know how all of it came about, but I know he was like, what they would do back then would, radio shows weren't like they are now. They were live broadcast. And he had a band, and they would go to like schoolhouses and churches or civic centers or whatnot during the evenings. And then they'd have to drive back for the 6:30 a.m. Broadcast. And there was a fellow named Pappy Hal Horton who was the radio disc jockey in the area. And he just, I guess, took a liking to Dad and you know, worked on helping, you know, getting airplay. And then, so that they did that for a few years. And then after my first brother was born in December of 50, my mom said, because she was the one doing most of the driving at night so the guys could sleep. You know, the typical, you know, nobody ever knows what the musician's wife goes through. She would sew his clothes, and he'd get up on stage, and then she'd drive the whole band. They'd put the bass fiddle on top of the old guitar, the old car, and, you know, and off they'd go to, you know, pick a little town in Texas within driving distance of Dallas, and they would have played. I've got a poster, too, I think, at home. That show where they were going to be. I can't remember where it is now to save my life, but this, I hadn't thought of this in a long time. But then after my brother Doug was born, my mom said, I'm not running all over the country and doing this. We're going to get our own place. You're making money for everybody else but you. And so she was the brains and he was the talent, which is true in most of the music world. Just nobody ever talks about it. So, and I'm not real sure if I've got the correct order. I know they got one that was at one time called the Bounty Ballroom, and something under the bridge. My husband knows some more of this because he's 9 years older than me, so he's more familiar with that history. And then in 51 or 2, he went downtown and got a place upstairs on Main Street. And it wasn't too long that, I think, was it? It was Tatches back then, or maybe Singer Harris. You know how they changed at some point. They bought out that building and I guess tore it down and built them a new big store. And he went somewhere else down on Main Street. And I actually have a picture of that building somebody sent me. It is still there. It's more like in the Deep Ellum area. And so that would have been 51, 53 area. And then about probably 55, 56, Jack Ruby was leasing what is now known as the Longhorn Ballroom, formerly the Bob Wills Ranch House. And I'm not sure what, I've had two or three people tell me what Jack Ruby called his place. So I'm not even going to go on record and throw a name out because I'll probably be wrong. But the agreement that Dad and Jack had, they didn't even know each other. I mean, Jack got hold of Dad and said, I want you to come down and be the band at whatever this place was. And Dad would get the door receipts and Jack Ruby would get the bar receipts. So Dad drew them in and he got to keep that money. And then when they drank, then Jack Ruby got to keep that money. And again, Dad, just a dumb old country boy, thinks everybody's good and honest and doesn't see the bad in anybody. And so he kind of had a handshake agreement with Jack. And that went on for a while. I'm not sure, maybe a year, you know, give or take a few months, either way. And business was good because Dad had quite the drawing power at that time. And, you know, there weren't very many places, you know. Dallas didn't have mixed drinks at that time that I know of. You know, it was all bring your own bottle. And so how the Jack Ruby situation ended was that one weekend they had a big crowd as usual, and of course, you know, it was a cash world back then, and nobody knew what in the world a credit card was. I'd have thought you was, you know, crazy in 1955 or 6. So there was a robbery, burglary at the Longhorn that Sunday night. And there were, like I said, there were two safes in the office. One was, and even up until the 80s, my mom called it Jack's safe, so we'd know which one was which, you know, that Jack had a safe, and that's where he put his money, and the other safe was where Dad put his money. And then on Monday or Tuesday, I guess, they would count it and take it to the bank and pay their bills, pay the band. So that particular night, the only money that was taken in a robbery was Dad, you know, they got Dewey Groom's safe, but they didn't touch Jack Ruby's safe. So, of course, they connected the dots and felt like that was an inside job from the get-go. And Dad said, you know, I'm not going to work for a fellow like that. And
that didn't sound very smart. Shouldn't they have just taken both?
Like biting the hand that,
yeah,
that
right.
feeds you.
Yeah.
And I'd have to really stop and think or maybe talk to some people. So if that would have been about, I'm going to say 56, I'm not sure where he was the next 2 years. He might have went back downtown, or maybe that was where the Bounty Ballroom came in. He went somewhere, obviously, and opened up a place. Or that might have been, at one time, he tried barbering, and he bought a little, matter of fact, the building's still there on Sine Road, Sine, you know, Buckner. And barbered for a little while, but he couldn't make any money at 50 cents a haircut, and he was used to making more money, you know. And he liked to talk a lot, so, you know, you weren't turning them heads over quick enough to make a count. But, okay, well, we've kind of got it up to, he hadn't got the Longhorn yet, but.
That's my next question.
Okay.
Is he bought it in 58, is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
And how did that happen?
Sorry. Need to take care of that? Okay. Well, O.L. came to Dad, O.L. Nelms, and of another aside while we were talking about Jack Ruby, and this was told to me by O.L. Nelms' daughter, Lee, that when the rent payment was due, you know, from Jack to O.L. Nelms, that Jack never paid the rent, but every month a check came out of Chicago from his sister. And they were never behind on the rent, but I just found it odd that a check out of Chicago from, you know.
Can you speculate what was going on there? I mean, I can't even imagine.
Oh,
was she kind of laundering money somehow? Is that the idea?
I don't want to get killed tomorrow. I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me that there wasn't something shady going on. Why else would my personal thought was it was mob money out of Chicago being sent to Jack, you know, for whatever purpose. I have no idea, but I just thought I would throw that in as an aside, because I found that really interesting when O.L.'s daughter told me that the check came out of Chicago from his sister monthly for the rent.
Were you old enough that you could remember Jack Ruby?
I remember when, you know, he killed Oswald, of course. And I was young. I was born in February of 58. But, you know, I was, what, 5 and a half? But it was such a vivid event. And the fact that Dad would watching TV and he'd say, well, there's Jack. Well, I've heard Jack Ruby's name my whole life. So I connected all that, you know, because, you know, you don't realize as a child what you pick up just through osmosis from hearing your parents talk. And so people like Bob Wills, Jack Ruby, O.L. Nelms, those names were, you know, I probably heard them every day of my life.
Yeah, what I remember is the signs that O.L. Nelms used
thanks
to have on the way to Six Flags. I'd
oh,
see
yeah.
it. I think that's where I see
yeah,
it.
Yeah, thanks for helping O.L. Nelms make another million. Yeah, he bought a lot of that old Grand Prairie bottom land and ended up making some money on it.
Ah, that was on the way to Six Flags then.
Yeah. Yeah.
From Dallas.
One time my cousin, who he just recently died a couple of years ago, but he was a bucket full of information about O.L. Nelms. O.L. kind of took him under his wing and told him more about O.L.'s life and how he would buy all that, you know, the Yellow Belly Dragway and all that stuff, I guess, on Jefferson, which is probably now, what, the old Fort Worth Highway, Highway 180 maybe. But he said back then, you know, if it rained, you know, in the 30s and 40s, maybe even 50s, you couldn't get through there, you know. And maybe that's why they ended up building the turnpike. I don't know. But
you know, I just realized we never really said what your dad's name was. Have we?
No, Dewey Groom.
Dewey Groom. There's quite a bit written about him and quite a bit not written. I've never seen a lot of this in the research I did. Mm-hmm. So he bought the Longhorn Ballroom in 58. What's your first memory of the Longhorn Ballroom?
I was 6 months old, so I don't know that I could tell you my first one. It was just, you know, we just went everywhere with Mom and Dad. It just, we didn't think, you know, she'd make us a pallet on the couch or something, and we spent half our time sleeping there, and then they'd take us home and go to school the next day. I don't know that I could tell you what my first actual memory is. Probably running and sliding on the dance floor when you're big enough to run and slide on a dance floor.
That sounds like fun, actually.
Yeah. Oh, we had a blast as kids. We'd take our roller skates and we'd roller skate around and play on the dance floor. Sometimes we'd get on the bandstand and mess with the instruments, but we got in pretty big trouble for that. And now that I'm married to a musician, I understand the last thing they need is a little 5-year-old up there plucking something.
In the research I was doing, I noticed, or I read, that the ballroom, and I guess it was when your dad had it, had some kind of interesting interior designs, like cactus beams. Well, what did the interior look like?
It was, I have some pictures from a brochure. And honestly, that's a good question for me to think about. I'm always just assumed that's the way it was built for Bob Wills, because it was Western inside. The support beams were plastered over into cactus that was, I don't know, what's that, 2.5-3 feet, you know, diameter. And you know, had the, I don't know what you call those, sequoia maybe.
Yeah.
With the, I call the arms sticking up. And then all the lights were wagon wheels and throughout. And I guess I probably should go back a little bit, back to 58 when the Longhorn came about, because I did skip some stuff. After Jack Ruby left because of the safe incident, it sat empty for a while. And a while being, I want to say a year. And I don't have anything to base that on. But O.L. Nams wanted, you know, he's got property sitting there and he wants somebody to rent it, you know, like anybody would in business. And he knew Dad had a following and was respected. And he went to him and said, hey, I got this place, you know, it was Bob's old place, and I want to sell it to you. I think you'd do good with it. And he was like, but nobody else has done good with it. It's too big. It's too, you know, the location, you know, too everything. And of course, they came to an agreement, obviously. And so Dad and NOL signed the papers that he would get it. And that's when I believe that may have been the other time he was downtown on Main, and he moved, brought that band out to what we now know as Longhorn Ballroom at 216 Corinth Street in Dallas. So that's where the actual Longhorn got started, and I believe it was in August or October.
A 58.
Yes.
Is there something special about the bar? I've read some things about that.
Now, Bob Will put in a silver dollar bar. It was gone before I had any memories. And he kept his horse there. I believe his horse name was Pumpkin. And as another just some history that I picked up on, I don't know if you've heard of Leroy Parnell, but he's a well-known Texas singer and had really good songs. His parents owned a ranch out in, I believe it was Stephenville, Glen Rose area, and when Bob wasn't at the ranch house with his horse, they would keep punking. And then it ended up being that Leroy Parnell became and got in the country music business, so he was around Bob Wills as a child too. So anyway, again, another little just aside that pops in my head.
Those are always interesting, those little asides, I think, because, you know, they may not be out there in the
nobody
public.
Knows that story,
exactly.
But James Pennybaker, who told it to me.
It's funny. So you worked there, right?
Yeah. And officially got started getting paid when I was a senior in high school. And what
your jobs there?
My first job, it's funny, I laugh because we were never, I have another brother, Richard, that's in between me and Doug. Doug was the older one, so he kind of got spoiled like most, and then 6-7 years later we came along and parents were a little bit smarter. So we weren't spoiled, we weren't taught that we were anybody better than anybody else, and that, you know, we just didn't get special or preferential treatment. So I say that because my first job where I was hired was to check hats and coats from 6:30 p.m. until 2 to 2:30 a.m.
And you were still in high school?
And I was still in high school. And Dad paid me $10.
A day?
No, $10 for that whole stretch. So that was about $1 an hour. A dollar and a quarter, maybe. And, of course, you got tips, which was probably 50 cents back then because I had to split it with somebody else. So that was actually my first job, paying job. And I did that for, I guess, from November until New Year's Eve. And when I came into work, they said, "We're going to have you be a hostess tonight." And I was like, "I don't want to be a hostess." And they're like, "Well, so-and-so couldn't make it, and we'll show you right quick how to do it." So I'm like, so they walked me around, said, "This is section so-and-so, and this is how you count the tables, and this is where you seat this group of people, and this is where you seat that group of people." So then I became a hostess after that. And I think the first night, one of the customers said, "Well, I got a tip for you." And I thought, okay, I have that in my hand. Like, you know, I'm 16 years old, and I'm looking to make a little money. I've jumped up a year in school, so I was always younger than everybody else. If you're wondering why I was a senior at 16. But instead of giving me any money, he said, "All right, here is a tip for you. Don't bet on the ponies." And, it wasn't so funny then, but it's kind of funny now. And probably pretty appropriate. You know, I never did bet on the ponies.
You followed his advice.
I followed his advice.
Were you a bartender at one point?
I had to wait till I was 18. So I was too young at that point. And then I became one of the bartenders.
Did they sell mixed drinks at that point, or was it just beer?
No, it was just beer, so it was basically more like a cashier and a bar back.
Are there any stories from those days? I mean, I know you've got a lot of stories about famous people, or maybe not some famous people. Yeah. So any funny stories that stand out?
My name is Paul Heckman. I am the Executive Director of Memories Incorporated, an IRS-approved 501c3 nonprofit. A few years ago, we saw a niche for Facebook pages free of politics and created our first page, Memories of Dallas, which is now well over 30,000 members strong. We have expanded our Facebook pages to include Memories of Texas, Memories of Texas Football, and Memories of Texas Music. We also have actual web pages for memoriesofdallas.org, memoriesoftexas.org, memoriesoftexasfootball.org, and meminc.org, our mothership. We are working on additional web pages now. Please come see us.
Are you looking for a podcast network that talks Texas by Texans? Well, check us out. You're already listening to us, but go to the website, lonestarpodcast.com. You can also find us on every big podcast platform, LSPN. We have shows in business, entertainment, marketing, music, of course, sports. We have some of the best sports podcasts in the state of Texas, ranging from high school football all the way up to pro basketball. So check us out online, lonestarpodcast.com. That's the LSPN on every major podcast platform.
Are there any stories from those days? I mean, I know you've got a lot of stories about famous people, or maybe not some famous people. Yeah. So any funny stories that stand out?
Ed Too Tall Jones would come in a lot on Monday nights, the famous Cowboy football player. And of course, at the time, I'm 5'3", so everybody looks tall to me. But he would kind of sit back there in the corner of the bar, and because he didn't want everybody to be seen. But, you know, like anybody else, you want to go out and have a good time and watch the concert, but you don't want everybody messing with you. And a lot of people would do that. Charlie Pride would come in, and Mom would turn out the lights in the lobby part, cashier part, the front office is what we called it. And so because the clubs were so dark anyway, you know, you couldn't see anybody in there. And Charlie and his wife would watch and listen to the band. And
what was he like?
Very nice, wonderful, wonderful gentleman. Never heard a bad word about him. He respected Dad a lot. The 60s, matter of fact, I got a picture from November of 67 where they're in Dad's office. It's on that Longhorn Facebook page. And you got to remember the times. In 67, 68, there was the race riots. There was, you know, ridiculous stuff in our history to look back on. And there wasn't anybody in country music like that. And, he came in and Dad listened to him, and he knew, I believe it was Jack Johnson or Billy Deaton. I think they were both involved in Charlie's background. One is a booking agent and one is a manager. And they booked Fair and Young and lots of people. And Dad didn't care. He got up and sang, and he said, the people like his music. It's doing good on the radio, and it's dance stuff. And that was his requirement. You couldn't just come in and do anything you wanted to do. You had to play a dance show. And Charlie did that, and of course the people loved him, and he went on to do great things. But, you know, I can't help but think that at that time in the country music business, when you got to play Conway Twitty would say, if you haven't made it until you played the Longhorn Ballroom stage. And, you know, once you get to that point, then you're accepted, you know. And
what was your dad's rationale in wanting not just to get up there and play music, but he wants to get people on the dance floor? What was the reasoning for that?
Western swing music is dance music. It makes you feel good. It's happy music. I have been interviewed before where they said, what is it about Western swing music? So, well, you got to, again, remember the time. I love history, too. That in the 30s and in West Texas, it was a bad time. People were hungry. They were starving. They had no crops. But Bob Wills would go over to somebody's house and everybody would get together and move the furniture out of the middle of the house, and they'd have a dance. And for a few hours that night, they weren't worried about starving to death and that the cow didn't give milk. And I think that's, you know, Western swing music and country music, that's the gift it gives to people. You can be happy for just a little while.
Makes sense. Was it a fun job? Was it hard?
It was fun and hard. I mean, again, my mom... You hustled when she was around, and the customer was king, and they were right, and you couldn't have a private conversation. If somebody walked up, you shut up and took care of them. That was our job, to take care. It didn't matter what, you know. We were probably the only, what I call full service, you know, some people call it a nightclub, a ballroom, whatever you want to call it, that we had parking attendants. I mean, from the time you came in, we had people that would park you. We had security that would walk you up if you felt unsafe, or a lot of times the security would just talk about the ball game or whatever. Everybody kind of just knew each other. It really was like a big family. And then, of course, they'd buy their ticket at the front, and then there'd be a hostess that would meet them and greet them and seat them. And then we had, you know, waitresses that, you know, it's not at all like today. You can't compare going to a club today to what it was in the 50s to the 80s. It's just such a different and culture and the character of people. And then, of course, you know, every song played was a dance song. And they took, you know, requests and most of the band, the early band, were actually the Bob Wills band that after Bob let his band go when he wasn't working so much, then most of them, little by little, just came to work at the Longhorn, and they were still playing the same, I say the same 10 Bob Wills songs, but because my husband does a lot of Western swing stuff. And we go to the shows, and I said, there might be 8 or 10 people booked on the show over the weekend. I said, but you're all still doing the same 10 or 12 songs. You're just doing it your way.
You mentioned it was like family. And actually, just in reading the Facebook page, I get the sense that, you know, people keep up with each other, next generation down. Can you talk a little bit about the relationships? And
We had so many people that were regulars, and they had their regular table, and many of them came 2, 3, 4 nights a week. You know, we were open Wednesday through Sunday. And a lot of them just came on Sunday, and they would drink coffee. I mean, a lot of people didn't even drink. You know, they came, it was, I guess, like a gathered place, a social activity. And they had, you know, a lot of little single ladies came out. We had one whole section that we would just seat single people when they come in because they wanted to dance. And we just got to know them, you know, because, you know, there's not many businesses nowadays that you see the same person walk in every Thursday night for 25 years. You know, they're gonna see you grow up. They saw me be pregnant. They saw me have my oldest daughter. You know, saw when I got married. You know, and they really were like family. And I give Dad a lot of credit to that because he understood people, and he loved people. I mean, there wasn't anything he liked better than. He would go out and say, all right, I'm going out amongst them. He'd come out of the office about, I don't know, 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night. And he made the rounds, and he sat with his customers. They talked to him. He knew about their family, and they knew about his family. And I think that's one reason a couple of times that the Longhorn has sold after Dad retired was because it was Dewey Groom's Longhorn Ballroom. Without the Dewey Groom, his people didn't come. And because he was their friend, and he wasn't there anymore. And the new owners stripped out all the cactus and the painted over the murals on the wall and took the ceiling out. I remember when Dad put the drop ceiling, because that was in the mid 60s. So at first, you know, of course, it's all the style nowadays that you have your open rafters and your electric wires and your air conditioning ducts. But at that time, that was tacky. So he added the false ceiling, I guess. And of course, they went in and they took all that out. And at some point, that Silver Dollar Bar that you had mentioned earlier, that I guess I rambled around, and somebody took all the silver dollars off of it. I'm not going to say it was Jack Ruby people, but who knows?
Maybe you're safe saying that now. I don't know. So did all this happen around 1964? Because I know your dad kind of expanded and did some upgrades and that kind of thing.
The upgrades started about 67, 68. And we took family vacations every year. We actually during the rest of the year we had really odd hours and family dynamic. But for 2 or 3 weeks every summer we would always go somewhere cool. Anyway, there was a movie set down south of San Antone, and where John Wayne had it built, actually, for the movie The Alamo, 1960, I think. So we went down there because Dad wanted to see it. Happy Shahan was the guy who ran it. But Dad liked the whole concept of that, of it having a place for horses, you know, the troughs and a saloon and a cafe and a barber shop or what have you. And so he took pictures of all that and brought it back, and I guess got with architects or whatever and said, this is what I want to do.
Interesting.
And, so that started in 67 or 8. And of course that went on for a good while. And that's when they increased the dance floor and built a new stage. I can kind of tell by looking at the pictures of what year it was, because I remember so many stage transformations, because a lot of it was like stuff that my mom would do, like putting, you know, making curtains or glitter or whatever little trinkets was on the wall. But well, I can, you know, I can put that to a time frame. And so I'm trying to think what else was remodeled about then. Oh, the Longhorn, up until about 67, had, it was kind of half the size it is now. If you're looking at the front of it, to the left was another club it was all part of the same complex, and OL leased that out, I guess, when Dad changed whatever it was he did when he started the remodeling. Either the contract had run out with the Guthrie Club, or I don't know that business decision. All I know is that the Longhorn proper took it over. And when they did, they went in and kind of stripped all that stuff out. There was one really long bar that had been there, I guess, from the Bob Wills days. I've never not seen it, I'll put it that way. And then a divider wall curtain was put in, so it basically became the overflow area. When we had too many people in the main part, then we would open up that curtain and have it set up, and we had a bar, and there was actually another entrance back there, but we never used it at the time. Although that is, from what I understand, that's the main entrance that they are using currently. But that was not the entrance that we used when it was under Dewey Groom's Longhorn Ballroom.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the people who were there, because it's a who's who list of country western people.
If you've been on the Facebook page lately, you've seen the pictures of Minnie Pearl. And literally, I mean, there's a picture of Mom and I think she's sitting in Willie Nelson's lap and Dad behind her. I'm sure Willie grabbed her and said, here, you know, because that was how Willie was. I mean, everybody, if you had a song on the Billboard charts in this, probably all the 60s, all the 70s, and half of the 80s, you played at the Longhorn. Just period. Randomly pick anybody out. If you had a song in the top 40 and you played dance music, you would have been there. You know, Ray Price, Fair and Young, Bob Wills, Leon Rouse played, Boxcar Willie, George Strait. One of his last concerts before he went big to Reunion Arena venue for New Year's Eve, what was at the Longhorn. And I want to say it was, October of 84, maybe, give or take. But Loretta Lynn, Tammy Wynette, George Jones, George Jones, Jerry Lee Lewis. Jerry Lee pulled one of his famous stunts of getting mad and kicking the piano over and cussing the people and telling them if they didn't like it, they can go to the door and get their money back. And I don't think he played anymore after that.
Your dad put a stop to that?
We ain't booking Jerry Lee anymore.
Mm.
And then one night, we had Merle Haggard booked and had sold out 2,000 tickets at $20 a ticket, which seems so cheap now, but that was one of our most expensive tickets at $20. I've got a ticket George Strait was $8 in here. Merle Haggard at $20. But at the last minute, he wasn't able to make it, and there's other stories floating around, but it doesn't really matter. He canceled and couldn't make it for whatever his reasonings were. And Dad called me at, gosh, probably about 10 o'clock the morning of the show, and he said, I need you to go to the bank right now and go get $40,000 in $20 bills. And this was in like 1981 or something. And you might as well have been telling me to go into Fort Knox and clean it out, because that scared the bejeebers out of me. I wasn't but about 21. And that's what he told me to do. So I went to the bank, and I got $40,000 in $20 bills, and I brought it back. And we started refunding people's money, and we had to pay for more radio spots. And, of course, the people were mad. I don't blame them. I mean, it's not like the internet where you can blast everything and everybody knows it in 30 seconds. You know, they went out to eat. They took off work. They hired a babysitter. I don't blame them for being upset. And, of course, I mean, we didn't like it either. We weren't, you know, he cost us money. So we refunded their money. Of course, our band is still going to play. You're welcome to stay and dance and have a good time. And you don't have to pay for anything. Just enjoy yourself. And most of the people actually did. I mean, you know, you're already there. You want to have a good time. You know, you got your money back. I don't know what else we can do for you. No.
What do you remember about Merle Haggard personally? What was he like as a person?
Businesslike. I remember back hostess when I was hostessing, a lot of times it was basically security guard kind of work, because back then nobody was going to hit a young girl if there was a problem. You could usually talk your way out of something. So they being mom or dad or Wilson Wren, who was our manager, would say, you get up there on the stage and don't let people get up on it. You know, and so I did that with Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard and Mel Tillis and probably Loretta Lynn, I think. You know, just kind of all runs together after a while.
Do you have any Willie stories?
He was fun. Going back to the 60s, you know, before Willie became Willie, when he was clean-cut Willie, you know, he had an unusual style and phrasing, an incredible, incredible songwriter. Nobody can top Willie Nelson for songwriting, and Kris Kristofferson maybe. But
again, this is part one. I want to thank you for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe so that you get part two when it's available.
As always, we have to thank our sponsors, Toothacres Pet Care Center. For all your boarding needs, choose Toothacres, because Toothacres cares. And I also want to thank you, the listener, for giving us your time and attention. Share these shows out on all your social media and help us preserve memories of Dallas. Until next time, I'm your host, Chris Daly, reminding you that the best thing about memories is making them. So go out and make some memories.